You hear a lot of talk of a better world, and some people have elaborated on plans to bring that about. For example, the Green New Deal. How exactly will that be implemented? Well, first of all, they want to get rid of fossil fuels in the next 10 years without really analyzing the impact of that, which means no more gasoline-driven cars, no more planes, or diesel trains or ships. The refitting of all homes in the U.S. to other fuels. I mean, you got to think about the work involved in such a deal like that. And the other thing, too, is it's not just anybody can go and retrofit a home. You got to know what you're doing. I mean, by trade, I'm a gas fitter. When I was working, I got a call to go relight a customer that had been shut off because he didn't pay his gas. So I go down the basement to relight his furnace, and I look to the beside the furnace, and there's a hot water tank. And one glance at it, I could tell it wasn't done by a gas fitter. I mean, it was 12-inch pieces of pipe, all kinds of 90s, at different angles, galvanized pipe, and I thought, this was done by one of this guy's relatives, obviously. And furthermore, there was no vent. So the products of combustion, including carbon monoxide, were just coming up into the ceiling of the basement. And I thought, this is a death trap. So by law, I'm required to shut it off and put a red tag on it. And then the customer is not allowed to turn it on until this is fixed properly. But this is just one example. When you're retrofitting a home, you've got to know what you're doing. They also claim that they will give you free education and free medical, even to the point of paying someone when he doesn't want to work. Now, this sounds good on paper, but what is the actual cost of such a deal? Well, it's only $93 trillion. I mean, not billions, but trillions, almost five times the current U.S. debt, which is currently around $22 trillion. I mean, common logic tells you that this is an unsustainable pipe dream, not based on reality. Yet some presidential candidates, and more than one apparently, will run with this idea on their platform. And it seems to me that the further away you get from what's involved, the more radical the ideas you come up with, because you have no idea of the concept of what it takes to bring about this concept or pipe dream you're presenting. So what do we really have today? We have wars in various parts of the world. We have murder in the big cities. 542 in Chicago, one city alone in the United States last year, which is over one murder a day. That's only in one city. Then you have legal abortions, the killing of the unborn, and not just the unborn, but there's a governor who was approving a situation where a baby is born, and they put the baby aside and make him comfortable, and then they have a little conversation with the woman. Do you want the baby or not? And if she doesn't want it, they're prepared to just let it die there on the table. I mean, that's how bad it's gotten. I mean, that's got to be an abomination in God's eyes. And of course, you have worldwide abortions. You know, according to WHO, every year in the world there are an estimated 40 to 50 million abortions. This corresponds to approximately 125,000 abortions per day, 5,250 per hour, and by the time services are over, there will have been some 10,000 innocent children murdered in the womb. That's the type of world we live in. In the U.S., approximately 600,000 abortions, legal abortions, are done, but this figure does not include illegal abortions. Now that's pretty appalling, brethren. Terrorist attacks are on the increase, with the recent one not that long ago in New Zealand, with 49 people being killed. Drug abuse, both prescription and illegal, is out of control. And with the legislation of legal use of marijuana in some states and across Canada. You heard of on the news, I heard on the news that there, after these laws are passed, there will likely be 1 in 5 drivers on the road high on something, either alcohol, drugs, or both. That's just pretty scary when you're out driving, you know. 1 in 5 under the influence of something. You can summarize these facts by stating the world is in a mess and will never achieve a better world in this age prior to the return of Christ, which begs the question, could we have a better world now? And the answer is yes, by following 10 simple rules, the 10 commandments. That's what I would like to talk about today. People I talk about love today. But what does the Bible tell us about love towards God and about love towards our fellow man, our neighbor? I mean, in spite of all the talk of love, what does God really tell us about it? Over in Matthew 22, if you'd like to turn there, Matthew 22, and we'll begin reading in verse 35. And we'll read verse 35 to 40. It says, "Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question." This is asking Christ a question, testing him, and saying, "Teacher, which is the greatest command in the law? Commandment in the law?" And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment." And in verse 39, "And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and all the prophets." These two commandments summarize how to love God by keeping the first 4 commandments, and how to love neighbor by keeping the last 6 commandments. Now, what does Christ also tell us? Let's go over to John 14, the book of John 14. In John 14 and verse 15, it clearly states, "If you love me, keep my commandments." If everyone did that today, we would have a better world. Demonstrating love to God is more than just lip service. It requires action on our part. Let's go over to the book of Exodus. Exodus 20. And verse 2, which is the commandments. We're going to deal with the first commandment right now. Exodus 20 and verse 2 says, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me." Brethren, we are not to have other gods before the one and true God. God brought each and every one of us out of the Egypt of this world and the bondage of this world. And for that, he requires total loyalty to him and him alone. Some people make gods of their jobs, of their careers, of their toys, of their money, seemingly forgetting where all these things they enjoy come from. I'd like to turn over to Matthew 6. A comment from Jesus Christ in Matthew 6. Matthew 6 and verse 24. Matthew 6:24, Christ speaking, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." It's just impossible. You've got to make a choice. And this is reiterated in the book of Luke, in the Luke 16, Luke 16 and verse 13, here again, Christ speaking. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, reemphasizing it. Whatever we serve becomes our master. Let's have a look at what Christ's response to Satan was in Luke. You're in the book of Luke. Just turn over to chapter 4 in the book of Luke. Luke 4 and verse 8 says, "And Jesus answered and said to him, 'Get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.'" So we are to worship and serve God only. The focus in our life, this is one of the four ways in which we demonstrate or show our love to God, obeying this first commandment. So if you go back to Exodus 20, you should keep a little thing there, because we'll be going there quite often since we're going over the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 20 and verse 2, Exodus 22, it says, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I am the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me." And also on the other side of the coin, "but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Notice here, also, if we love God, we show it by keeping the commandments. How would this impact the world? This, just keeping this commandment alone. Well, you would have no more statues in churches. No more Buddhas or images worshipped by others in other religions. No more crosses in churches and steeples. And it would have an impact. Paul, in the book of Acts, I don't want to turn there, but it came to mind where there was this black silversmiths that were really upset about Paul because he was preaching the gospel and probably telling them that idols are wrong. And here they were making these idols to the goddess, one of the goddesses there in the temple. And then he says, "We got to do something about this. This is affecting our trade. I mean, if everybody goes along with what he's saying, you know, it starts affecting my pocketbook. I'm going to push back on Paul." But here again, there might be some pushback, but get used to it, because there won't be any more idols to be made. Also, as was quoted in a recent Q&A by Paul Niehoff from Australia, regarding the Second Commandment, which was quite an interesting article, here's a quote from what he wrote. It says, "The Second Commandment states that we must not make a carved image in likeness of anything in heaven above, or in the earth, or in the water underneath the earth, to bow down to them or serve them." And he has in brackets, "compared to Deuteronomy 5, 8 to 9. You're not required to turn there. I just wanted to quote it. This refers clearly to some kind of physical idol or image. He goes on to say, "However, idolatry is more than the worship of images or even the wrongful desire for physical things." Returning to Ezekiel 14, verses 3 and 4, if you'd like to turn there, Ezekiel 14, he's quoting from Ezekiel in regards to the subject of images. Ezekiel 14:13 says, "Son of man, these men have set up their idols in their hearts and put before them that which causes them to stumble into iniquity or sin. Should I let myself be inquired of by all of them?" And in verse 4, "Therefore speak to them and say to them, thus says the Lord God, every one of the house of Israel who sets up his idols in his heart and puts before him what causes him to stumble into iniquity and then comes to the prophet, I, the Lord, will answer him who comes according to the multitude of his idols And carrying on in verse 5, he says, that I may seize the house of Israel by their heart, because they are all estranged from me by their idols. So he quotes here, he says, the Sonsino commentary explains, more literally, have brought up their idols to their hearts, an idiom for have set their mind upon their idols. The phrase does not imply that they were worshiping idols, but that their thoughts were influenced by pagan ideas, such as believing in magical spells and divination. This has been a stumbling block to them, willfully placed by themselves in their way and leading them into iniquity. So you can see we can be guilty by having idols in our own hearts and in our minds, I should say. Okay, now back to Exodus 20. We'll look at the third commandment. Exodus 20 and verse 7 says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. I mean, go to any work site today and the air is just blue with cursing and using God's name in vain. If everyone kept this commandment, which would really have cleaner air. When I first started in my job, the job I retired from, I landed up, we were working on three-man's crews. I was the flunky because it was, you know, the most current employee, and there was a foreman, and then there was a backhoe operator. And we worked as teams installing gas services to homes, you know, putting the pipe in the ground and hanging the meter by the house. And I got stuck with this guy. He was so foul-mouthed. I mean, you'd go to a restaurant, he'd make the most crudest comments about the waitress. And I mean, it just, and you know, you'd ask him to, you know, stop. He'd just ignore you. He was a senior, you know, member of the union. And at the end, I just got so fed up. I went up to my supervisor and I says, listen, I says, you got to take me off that crew. I do not want to work with that guy anymore. I mean, he's just the foulest mouth I've ever had. And fortunately, the supervisor, he knew this guy. He said, I understand where you're coming from. And he moved me to another crew. But I mean, some people that just, every other word is a curse or using God's name in vain. Using God's name in vain also means the use of euphemisms such as gee or gosh and a host of others that people, they don't realize by using God's name in vain. These euphemisms do that. Remember, the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Going on to the fourth commandment, in Exodus 20, verses 8 to 11, I believe. Yes. Exodus 20 and verse 8 says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. Verse 10, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. And then continuing in verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. Now God says, remember the Sabbath, and the world quickly forgets and worships on Sunday, worship on Friday, every other day of the week, other than what has been commanded. What we have to remember is the Sabbath is part of the creative works of God. It's part of creation week. If you go over to Genesis 2, and verse 2 and 3 in Genesis 2. In Genesis 2, in verse 2 it says, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done. He rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. In verse 3, then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. Like I stated, it was part of creation week. God blessed it, sanctified it by putting his presence in it. It was part of the work which he created and made. That's why Christ could boldly state that he was Lord of the Sabbath. He instituted it. He knew exactly what was acceptable to do or not to do on the Sabbath. Fully explained in our new booklet, How to Keep the Sabbath, goes into that very topic very thoroughly. So if you have any questions about what's acceptable to God to do on the Sabbath, read our current booklet. Let's turn over to Exodus 31, because God talks more about the Sabbath. In Exodus 31, in verse 13, Exodus 31:13, it says, "Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, Surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." In verse 14, "You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant." Not a temporary one, but a perpetual one. And we are spiritual Israelites. "It is a sign between me and the children of Israel." It's also a sign between God's people and God. "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." Now notice he speaks here of Sabbaths, plural, which include the annual holy days. They are a sign that we may know the one and true God, not a false God, not a God of Sunday or a God of Friday or a God of the weekly days, but the true God, the God of the Sabbath. The Sabbath is holy. In verse 17, it's a sign not just for a few years, but and not done away with, but for a long time. For, even in a millennium, we'll be keeping the Sabbath. He was rested and he was refreshed. He didn't rest because he was tired. I mean, he stood back, in other words, and looked at what was created, and he was refreshed. He was happy with the product, pleased at what he had accomplished. Similar to a person stepping back from his work, something he's building, something he's working on, a piece of art or building something. Sometimes you get so involved and you step back and you just look at it and you refresh, you enjoy it. You say, that looks good. And that's how God felt. He says he was happy with the product. He had created the earth, created the animals, created the ocean, created the Sabbath, a day for us to worship him. Signs give direction and identity, like a name badge, you know, tells you who you are. Or a yield sign that gives you some direction. Go this way. The Sabbath is our sign that we worship the one and true God, the God of creation, and not some false God, in which there are plenty of in the world. Summarizing the first four commandments, these first four commandments show or demonstrate and give us direction on how to truly love God. There are not 20 ways, a mere 4 ways, and they're simple to understand. And they come from God and not from man. And since they are from God, we know that they are the only way to truly show love towards God, our Creator. Now I'd like to cover the last 6 commandments, which show us how to love our neighbor. So if you'd like to turn to Exodus 20. Exodus 20 and in verse 12, it says, "Honor your father and your mother." And there's a promise here that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. A simple thing like honoring your father and mother, God says you'll live longer in the land. In this age of same-sex marriage, high divorce rates, it's confusing for children to honor their fathers, especially if the father was a sperm donor of a marriage, or a relationship between two women. In reality, it would be impossible for that child to honor his father. He wouldn't know who the father was. Let's go over to Leviticus 19. You know, there was once a time when children honored an older person. You know, today they steal their purses and take advantage of them. Over in Leviticus 19 and verse 32, an admonition here, it says, "You shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear your God. I am the Lord." When I was young and growing up, I mean, I was raised in the Catholic Church, but at Christmas time, there used to be this older man that used to come around to our house. And I remember so clearly, my mom and dad would say, "When this man comes in, I want you all to stand." Because he was in his 70s. His hair was all gray, like very similar to Mr. Armstrong. And when he came in, everybody stood up. And he came in and he would smile at everybody and say hi to everybody. And he'd say, "Go ahead and sit down." But we showed him honor. You don't see that today. I mean, I was shocked. I mean, in 2007, when we were in England, we had gone to England for the feast, and after the feast, we went down to London, and we booked into the hotel, and then I said to Delia, I said, "Let's take a, you know, the underground to go downtown England, because I want to look around." And we had to go on a bus for part of that leg to get down there. So we get on the bus, and a young person actually got up and let Delia sit down. I mean, we were both shocked. Nobody got up for me, but they got up for Delia. And when we, you know, got off the bus, and we both said, we were kind of shocked that that person did that. You know, it was really nice to see that they honored an older person and give up their seat for them. But today, there's so much disrespect for elders. I mean, I read that an 87-year-old woman was beaten up by someone grabbing her purse. There's just no respect for the elder. It's just a horrible situation. If everyone kept this command, it would be great joy in the world. What would it really be like if everyone honored their mother and father? Over in Zechariah, there's a scripture. It's kind of a millennial setting, but this is what the world could be like in Zechariah, the 8th chapter. I'm always moved in the sense by this picture it paints. You know, in Zechariah 8 and verse 4, it says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, old men and old women shall again sit in the streets of Jerusalem," obviously referring to the future, "each one of them, one with his staff in his hand, because of great age." So they'll live for a long time, great age, elderly people. And verse 5, "The streets shall be full, of boys and girls playing in the streets." Not fighting, playing in the streets. Not playing on their handhelds. This could be what we see in every city if this simple commandment was kept. Let's go back to Exodus 20. And Exodus 20 and verse 13, a very short commandment, it says, "You shall not murder." Now, just think of the impact if this commandment was kept. There'd be no more wars. There'd be no more gang killings. There'd be no more abortions. I mean, millions of people would be saved because of this law. And yet, millions are killed in wars today or in the past. Stalin murdered 20 million of his own people. I mean, it's just mind-boggling in what has gone in the past. What a world it would be if this commandment was kept. Let's go over to Matthew 5 and words of Christ in regards to war in a sense, but in Matthew 5, the words of Christ here, he says in verse 9, he says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." And what does one of our hymns say? Seek peace, pursue it earnestly. If everyone sought to seek peace and pursue it earnestly, we would certainly have a better world. And that comes from Psalm 34, if you'd like to turn there. Psalm 34. It says, Psalm 34 in verse 14, it says, depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Keeping this commandment worldwide would be a wonderful thing. Also, there's a spiritual application in this, and that's found in Matthew 5. In Matthew 5, I don't have this one written down, so I've got to turn to my Bible. Matthew 5, beginning in verse 21, Christ speaking, it says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled with your brother and then come and offer your gifts. In other words, do that first before you bring the gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way, and then lest your adversary deliver you to the judge and the judge hand you over to the officer and you're thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. So an admonition, too, that it's not just a matter of doing the physical act, but even hating your brother in your heart is like killing him. So we've got to be conscious of that, too. There's the spiritual aspect of the law and the physical aspect of the law. Back to Exodus 20 and verse 14, talking about the next commandment, commandment number 8, Exodus 20, 14 says, you shall not commit adultery. Now, the breakdown of marriage and getting away from what constitutes a real marriage in God's eyes, which is a marriage between a man and a woman, will eventually lead to total destruction of the family unit, which is the very foundation and building block of any society or nation. As stated regarding divorce, it is between 42 to 46 of marriages. That's how many marriages end in divorce today, 42 to 46%. And it just destroys family. And it affects children for a long time. A great percentage of marriage breakdown are caused by adultery. And it's amazing. It destroys family. This is what God says about divorce. If you'd like to turn to Malachi, in the second chapter of Malachi, Malachi 2 and verse 16, it says, for the Lord God of Israel says he hates divorce, for it covers one's garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. It really destroys families. It leaves permanent scars. A few years ago, I was watching Oprah Winfrey, a program on there. They had a 38-year-old woman. I mean, she was almost a basket case. You know, an older woman, she had children, because her parents divorced when she was young. She was still suffering from the effects. I mean, 20 and 25 and 30 years later, the impact on her, she could barely talk about it. So some people think, oh, well, the kids will be fine. We'll just get divorced and we'll move on. They'll make out. No, it leaves scars and permanent scars. What does God tell us? Over in Proverbs 5, this is what God tells us. In Proverbs 5 and verse 18, it says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. That's the command from God. We're to rejoice with the wife of our youth and work your problems out. It's like, till divorce do we part. I mean, you know, that's how marriages are today. It's not till death do we part, it's till divorce do we part. It's a horrible, terrible curse on society, the way marriages break down. It's just hard on everyone. Over in, given some more outlines on what God feels should be done in Genesis 2, and verse 24, Genesis 2:24, it says, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Husband and wife are meant to work as a team, just like God and Christ work as a team. And there's also a spiritual application to this found in Matthew 5. If you'd like to turn to Matthew 5. Matthew 5 and verse 27. Christ speaking, verse 27. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery within his heart. So adultery begins in the mind, in other words, in the heart. And you can be as guilty of lust as you can of the actual act itself. So we've got to bear that in mind, and brethren. There's such an attack by Satan on marriages and on youth today. I'll be so glad when all this madness is over, to tell you the truth. Okay, back in Exodus. Exodus 20 and verse 15. This is the ninth commandment that says, Exodus 20, 15, you shall not steal. I think one of the biggest areas of cheating is on a person's income tax. You know, it's funny, a man would never go into a bank with a gun to make a withdrawal, but he would fudge in paying taxes because he thinks he can get away with it, and it's like a white-collar crime. I'm not really hurting anybody. I remember reading in Reader's Digest years ago, there was a huge company in the States where they sold all kinds of nuts and bolts and pipe fittings and those type of things, you know, washers and screws and various types. It was a 5 or 6 story building, employed hundreds of employees. And all the employees left at 4 o'clock, went out to the parking lot to go home. You know, they work in day shift. And there was microphones or speakers, I should say, in the parking lot. There was an announcement. Will all the employees please come back, you know, into the conference room, there's an important announcement to make. So everybody went in there and they sat down, and then they had an important announcement to make, and then everybody listened to the announcement, and they all went back to their cars and they all went home. And there was tons of stuff on the ground. I mean, they all emptied their pockets. They figured we're going to have a search. I mean, nuts and bolts and screws and pieces of pipe. And the management, and they were shocked. They didn't realize that their employees were robbing them blind, or only till they need glasses, really. But you know what I mean? They changed the policy after that. They started doing some checks on people because they just assumed they were honest employees. But these guys had loaded up their pockets, and when they heard the announcement, they thought, they're going to do a search. So they just emptied their pockets. And after the meeting was over, they're not going to pick up the stuff off the ground. They just drove away and left all the stuff on the ground. And people come up with some schemes to steal. I was told the story about a lady who works for a distillery. Now, on the distillery, they check your lunch bucket when you left because, you know, didn't want anybody putting a Mickey in the lunch bucket. But she had a water bottle that she would fill up and put it in front of her, you know, and she was a heavy woman, and nobody had ever did a body search. They just assumed she was fine. So every day she was stealing, you know, a bottle of whiskey from the distillery. I mean, people come up with some great plans to steal stuff. It's just amazing. All kinds of schemes and defraud people, and especially older people. I mean, I'm appalled when I hear and read about these scammers that take advantage of old people on the phone, you know. I mean, which is, it's bad enough when you're younger and you're getting taken advantage, but to take advantage of older people is just criminal, you know, stealing them from their savings without even batting an eye. And that's the type of world we live in. Another area where people fall short is tithes and offerings. which is robbing from God. What does Malachi 3 tell us? Let's go over to Malachi 3 and verse 8. Malachi 3:8 says, will a man rob God? That's a question. Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? In other words, what do you mean? How have we robbed you, God? And he replies, in tithes and offerings. Not just tithes and offerings, but let's look at what Paul's admonition was. What is it? In Ephesians, Paul gives an admonition to the brethren there. Ephesians 4 and verse 28. Paul talking to the Ephesian church, he says, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. So obviously there was a problem there. Otherwise he wouldn't have brought this up. Some of them were stealing. Don't do it anymore, he says. You can also steal from God by what? Not praying. You steal time, which should be allotted to God, and also some types of neglect are a form of stealing. In other words, if you neglect to do something, that's a form of stealing. Let's go over to Exodus 20 for the last commandment. Exodus 20 and verse 17 says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant. And today's language would be his car, his boat, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. In other words, we should be content with what we have. Let's go over to 1 Timothy. And 1 Timothy 6. And we'll read verses 6 and 8. 6 and 8. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 6. It says, now godliness with contentment is great gain also. And also, in dropping down to verse 8, it says, and having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Some people are content with little. For others, it's never enough. There used to be a cartoon years ago called Dennis the Menace. Some of you that know about him are older like myself. But I remember one time at Christmas time, I was looking at this cartoon, and this is Dennis the Menace, and there was a pile of toys, probably 4 feet high, you know, like pyramid shape, because, you know, they all piled up. And Dennis the Menace is sitting on top. And the caption at the bottom is this all? I mean, you know, greed knows no bounds. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 12. Luke 12, and we'll read verse 15. Luke 12, 15. And he said to them, take heed and beware of covetousness. In other words, watch out. You've got to watch out for it. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. In other words, brethren, you're not being judged by God by the size of your bank account or how many toys you've accumulated in your life, but rather your good works and the fruits in your life. That's what counts to God. He's not impressed with the fact that you have 3 or 4 cars and half a dozen other toys in the yard. No, that doesn't impress God. It's good works and the fruits of the Spirit. So in conclusion, politicians want to give us a better world through plans and schemes which, when analyzed, are totally unrealistic and unattainable when it comes to the new green plan. God gives us and shows us the way to achieve that goal, and it's not really that complicated, and if adhered to, would bring worldwide peace, and not only that, but prosperity. Unfortunately, The simple solution of keeping the Ten Commandments is the farthest thing from people's minds. By keeping the commandments, they are a way, the only way to demonstrate your love for God. People talk about love. That's just a word. You demonstrate it by keeping the commandments, as outlined in the first four commandments. They show us, demonstrate, proof that you love God. God is not demanding 100 ways to please him and love him, but just four ways. These are mostly rejected by man, and you have the religious confusion in the world today. God also shows us how to love our fellow man, not by 200 or so ways, but by six. These six ways demonstrate, the proof is in the pudding, our love for a fellow man. We are fortunate as God's people to be privileged to take advantage of these truths and enjoy the benefits now. Later on, after the return of Christ, there will not be all kinds of humanly devised ways to worship and love God and our fellow man, but rather the Ten Commandments. That will be the guide and the way that this world will worship, show love towards God, and show love towards neighbor. So let's make sure we're keeping them now, brethren, so we can be proper lights in this dying world.